Well, thank you for having me. I'm Clayton Jackson. I'm a fourth year student with Suzanne Stimmer. I work with perovskite titanates. I do growth, crystal growth, and characterization. And I want to discuss with you some of our recent work in interface-induced magnetism in perovskite quantum wells. So a quick outline. So I want to introduce the material systems that we're working with, these complex oxide heterostructures, and how we get these extreme density two-dimensional electron gases into these quantum wells, and then use that to facilitate our discussion on interface-induced magnetism. In particular, I'll be talking about how we see anisotropic magnetoresistance in these gadolinium titanate, strontium titanate, gadolinium titanate heterostructures. We've also grown some samarium titanate, strontium titanate heterostructures, and done some comparison studies on that, and it's pretty interesting. And then I'll close with a brief summary. So one of the neatest things about this class of materials, these different perovskite titanates, is you can take a material like strontium titanate, it's a band insulator, it has a nonpolar unit cell, and epitaxially interface it with something like any of the rare earth titanates, and you get these extremely large 2D systems at the interface. And in this class of materials, you get the charge in the strontium titanate side, the wider band gap insulator. The carry densities are on the order of 3 times 10 to the 14, which is an order of magnitude larger than is even achievable in semiconductors. So it's really interesting. In addition, the perovskite titanates play host to all sorts of other really interesting features. Strontium titanate is a band insulator, exhibits superconductivity at very low temperatures, and then you have this whole range of magnetic Mott insulators where you can get ferromagnetism to antiferromagnetism depending on the rare earth element you put in this perovskite structure. So the two materials that we're interested in is ferrimagnetic gadolinium titanate, which is a Curie temperature of 30 Kelvin, and we can get that down to about 20 Kelvin in thin film. It's a 4 nanometer, a small coercive field. And then samarium titanate is antiferromagnetic, needle temperature of around 50K. So what we were doing when we were growing these quantum wells is looking for interactions between these different interfacial materials, in particular the magnetic insulator, and this two-dimensional electron gas. So the quantum well allows us to study correlation and proximity effects at these extreme limits of both confinement and carrier density.
So that the two diagonals are high density. Is it more than that?
Yeah, it has to be.
Basically, should I think of it as quasi-3D in a
way? I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's a lot going on there. You get so some of the subbands are very, very strongly confined and have probably most of the charge in them, and then there's some spread. But with our quantum wells, we're looking
both two-dimensional characters.
And, yeah, I think it depends on it depends on how you grow it. Like if I'm looking at a very thick STL, I'm going to see a pretty broad spread, I think, it in that charge. But with these quantum wells, these are single SRO to 1 or 2 nanometers. So
can you give them effective mass?
Shinnecott Haase oscillations gave us an effective mass of about 1 for what we could see. We took it to Tallahassee, where the mobilities in these films are relatively low. We saw Shinnecott Haase accounted for about 30% of the charge, and it looked like a single subband, possibly a spin split subband, but that's a whole different.
Yeah, so you have a huge density of states as well, right? So that means you can get more than just into one subband than you would do in
the That's a very anisotropic mass, so it's out of plane, it's very high. It's maybe like 20 or something, extremely high. In plane, for some of these subbands, it's one.
Yeah, but that's something we're still exploring. Okay. So, as I mentioned previously, we're fabricating these gadolinium titanate, strontium titanate, gadolinium titanate heterostructures. When I discuss them, I'm going to refer to them just by the number of SRO layers. But anytime I have more than one, there's going to be a titanium oxide layer in between the strontium oxide layers. So what we observe is that in these quantum wells, we get an insulating state, and we have less than or equal to 2 SRO, and then with the addition of just one more SRO layer, we get this really strong drop in sheet resistance, and then we have these conductive films. And then by varying this width of the quantum well, we can vary the effective 3D density in these quantum wells. And if it's really important to emphasize that the conduction here is definitely occurring in our strontium titanate layer. If we take an insulating gadolinium titanate film and then dope it to a comparable charge density using strontium. And then we look at the conduction, we see a significantly lower mobility than what we see in our 3S RO, our thinnest conducting quantum well. So it's pretty interesting. Now, the main point of the talk is to discuss what we've observed here. We're looking at magnetoresistance at low temperature, and we see the onset of this hysteretic effect, which occurs around 5 Kelvin. So the remainder of the talk is going to be in discussing where this is coming from and what we can do experimentally to try and determine that. I'm sorry?
One of these materials becomes superconducting?
Strontium titanate, the band insulator. It's like 360 millikelvin or something like that. It's very low. It's not within this range. Okay. So one thing I want to emphasize about the magnetoresistance hysteresis that we've observed is how it differs from the magnetism that we see in gallium titanate. So gallium titanate, as I mentioned before, is a Curie temperature of around 20 Kelvin. But what we're seeing in these quantum wells is the onset of this hysteresis at a much lower 5 Kelvin. In addition, if we associate the dip in our hysteresis with the coercive field, we see that that's almost an order of magnitude larger than the coercive fields that we see in even thin film gadolinium titanate. Okay, so two ideas that are out there that can describe this sort of hysteretic behavior is spin Hall magnetoresistance and anisotropic magnetoresistance. And one way we can try and discern between the two or further characterize the system is by looking at the angular dependence in our magnetoresistance. So what we did was vary the angle between magnetic field and current, which we've defined here as alpha, and then the angle between magnetic field and the plane of the film, which we've designated as beta. And then using that characterization, we were able to look at longitudinal and transverse magnetoresistance and compare to these expressions to try and discern between these two.
The system is very anisotropic, right? The film itself. So if there would be an AMR signal, it doesn't have to be only dependent on the magnetization direction, it also depends on the orientation of the current with respect to the crystal axis.
I remember reading about that.
It was T-sub, maybe read for the data.
Yeah, I mean, the domain, I think.
T-sub, there's some NS sort of in the system and stuff. Something to consider. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a basic question about the structure. Is the structure in Russian mirror symmetric? Basically, top and bottom are the same?
Top and bottom are the same.
Yeah.
In terms of, yeah. Almost symmetric.
In that case, shouldn't, maybe it's a question to Garrett, SMR, shouldn't they require kind of mirror breaking? I mean, can you even get SMR?
Oh, it's even larger.
Yeah.
If you have two on both sides, it should be a, that's when you get the strongest effect.
Yeah, right? Has the equations
The point is not SMR.
Yeah. Well, when we first looked at this, we were thinking that it was going to be this very large SMR effect because it's so pronounced. It's much bigger than what other people report in SMR, but it doesn't, as you'll see, follow that trend. So here's the magnetoresistance data as a function of alpha. We fixed beta at zero here, which is where we get the most pronounced effect, and you can see a crossover from dip to peak at the low field, and then if you look at the high field, you see the largest values here at alpha equals 90 and the smallest at alpha equals 0. This is the longitudinal magnetoresistance, and this is the transverse or planar Hall. So the relative changes here are pretty considerable, particularly in RXY where you have shifts greater than 20%, which is a lot.
Well, they're clearly not saturated, right?
No.
Any idea what happens if you go to higher fields?
Well, I've taken them out to 9 Tesla, which is what our limits here, and you basically see the same sort of.
I don't think they should saturate.
Yeah.
Given the current temperature.
So that means that you have some
you should either have some sort of very, very hard magnetic textures or something else.
No, I think it's sitting on this negative magnetic resistance background, right?
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't center.
And that was something like anti-localization, or what is this negative resistance?
I don't think it's anti-localization because it's very relatively, for a 2D system, I would expect it to go away from in the out of my direction, right? So it looks very almost symmetric, so I don't think it's anti-localization.
So that is something which is not understood, is that correct? You don't see it in the bulk materials.
You couldn't even do these measurements with just a thin film again.
Anisotropy also is still there at very large magnetic fields, or is the anisotropy only at rather low field?
This feature I think persists at least out to the fields that we've looked at. So, as I mentioned before, very large changes. One thing to note is that if I'm just looking at the absolute changes in resistance, that they're comparable for both RxX and RxY.
Oh, can I ask another question about this expressions moment resistance in terms of SMI and EMA? If you just take a step back and expand moment resistance to second order magnetic components, just based on symmetry. Can you always write it in terms of some combination of what you call SMR and AMR? Or there some
AMR, other? It's very long. It's going to get to that. It's going to get to that.
But just before we even, I mean, you say that together, it's SMR theory and AMR theory, mm-hmm. We just take a step back and say, well, based on symmetries, you know, in principle, you know, in your structure, any magnetic resistance can be decomposed into these two types of contributions. So there are other terms allowed by symmetries. Have you thought about that?
Okay, no, I don't think
but
I have.
But AMR don't fit very well, so it doesn't, SMR really doesn't.
I understand, so my question is specifically about this decomposition.
Certainly.
No, I understand, it's definitely something that I'd like to investigate.
SMR, you can get higher harmonics.
And I talk about SMR per se or AMR, I'm just talking about just symmetry-based decomposition. Right? Mm-hmm. In certain theory, SMR theory, this decomposition popped out, and another theory, another decomposition popped out. And the question is that the full story based on symmetries?
Right. No,
up to second order magnetic components.
I think so.
Is that the full set of possible terms allowed by symmetry?
I'm not sure.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
My question, if you haven't thought about that would be good.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
It should be nothing to do with the theories. That's all for.
Of course, if you've got this, at least in cubic or isotropic materials, of course you can have other...
I'm talking about this particular material, this crystal, this experiment, that's it.
This material is anisotropic, it's like...
That's what I'm saying, so it depends. You can have, of course, anisotropic.
Well, the question, it's a binary question. Are the answers either yes or no? It's not like...
No, absolutely not. You are what I'm telling you. Because it's of course a quantitative problem, right?
No. I'm asking a qualitative question, just based on the symmetries. How you can decompose quantum resistance in terms of magnetic position?
It depends on the crystal symmetries, right?
Yes, but here's a crystal, right? I suppose you guys understand the symmetries of the crystal, right? I mean, it's okay. So let's take it even further step back. Do you understand the symmetries of the crystal?
I mean, I understand the structure.
So then there's no question. Then there's no ambiguity.
Okay, well, I'll look into it. Thank you.
One thing that should possibly be done is look at the anisotropy. The problem right now, if it has anything to do with the GTO, this is a multi-orientation.
Yeah, in the Galilean tightening.
So what we need to look at anisotropies, what we need to do is grow on a different substrate that gives us a single orientation variant.
Yeah, which is not the case.
Experimentally, at this point, yeah.
Okay, so SMR, at least these formula don't match up with what we're seeing, but if we consider AMR and the possibility of a negative delta rho A term here, then we get really good agreement with both our RxX and our RxY. So we see a minimum in RxX for alpha equals 0 and maximum at alpha equals 90. And same thing here for this term. We get the same agreement. A maximum for alpha equals 135 and a minimum for alpha equals 45. I'll try and hurry. If indeed what we're looking at is this negative AMR effect, then we can expect to see the cosine dependence on beta and RxX as we go to larger and larger fields, and that's exactly what we observe. So this is also in really good agreement. And one thing that's pretty interesting is if we tilt to alpha equals 90 and then repeat the same measurement, we still see some sort of angular dependence, but this doesn't really agree with any of the formula that we have at our disposal. So it's still something to look into. As I mentioned before, we also looked at samarium titanate, strontium titanate, quantum wells. Very similar structure, slightly thinner layers, and we went to larger fields here and swept back and forth, and there's absolutely no hysteretic effects. So clearly the ferromagnetism in the gallium titanate, strontium titanate system is dependent on the gallium titanate being present. Another interesting thing about this is that we see the same sort of anisotropy in beta as we did in the gallium titanate, strontium titanate system. So for alpha equals 90 degrees, which tells us that this effect is independent of that the magnetism we were seeing in the STL. And with that, a very brief summary. Thank you very much for your time and your discussion. So I don't follow.
The next slide, I think.
The samarium titanate? Here? So this bullet point is referring, so I mentioned here that we see this strange behavior that doesn't really fit with any of the expressions we're trying to use to describe our system. So this agrees really well. All of this agrees really well. And then we should see, if it were all consistent, nothing here. But we're seeing something. And it's just it was just a comment, essentially. That we see this behavior that doesn't really match up with anything we have, but we see that same sort of odd behavior in this system, where we see that same sort of behavior in the samarium titanate, strontium titanate, quantum well. So all I'm saying is that it's not contingent upon, it's not directly related to this sort of behavior, like the hysteretic effects we're seeing in the gallium titanate-based quantum well.
Is this delta rho A now magnetic field dependent or not?
Is it delta rho A magnetic field dependent? I guess I could go through and do. I mean, this analysis was qualitative, so I didn't do any fitting.
This is rather important information, but still in the high field limit. Mm-hmm. The low field limit, of course, anything can happen, but in the high field limit,
whatever. No, I should.
It's constant, and it's really something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. Thanks.
Is there interface states, boundaries? William Titanite is an insulator, so it can support surface states in principle. And then due to spin orbit coupling, their dispersion. Their in-plane dispersion would depend on the orientation in the meditation. So you can just have different scattering rates for electrons interacting with those states. They can have different wavelengths, for example. What kind of angular dependence would you expect from this mechanism?
I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that. I'd have to really think about that.
Angular dependence for the
ionization
varying in any plane, it would be possible.
Okay. Yeah, we were mostly looking to explain. I mean, it's really strong crystallitic effect is clearly a sign of some sort of ferromagnetism.
No, of course, if there was no ferromagnetism, there would be no dependence.
Yeah,
on the inflation.
Yeah, but there
would
be some
dependence
on the inflation.
Can you speculate about? Actually, I'm not clear in my mind based on what kind of proximity effect you think might be happening that sort of would be consistent.
It's a sort of exchange coupling. So we have two on the both sides of the interface, two very similar. We have titanium D-states on both sides of the interface.
But as you apply magnetic fields, what's happening? I was actually, maybe I just was not listening carefully enough, but you're thinking that the magnetic field has them. Is it enough to just think about magnetizations in the top and the bottom layer, or somehow have to think how proximity effect is responding to the magnetic field as well?
So we think this magnetization is in the entire formula, the orange, you know, transmutation.
But that's probably, you know, that's locked into to the magnetization and the. So the ferromagnets are top and the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, and as your magnetic field, so there's some, I presume, some crystalline anisotropy or something in play, and the shape anisotropy.
Right, you would expect that, like, this very thin film, right? The magnetization lies in the plane.
In the,
probably for both, so for both the quantum and the Galilean plane.
Yeah. In the plane.
Yeah.
So then the proximity effect, whereas as you apply ferromagnetic field in the, let's say there's some average magnetization, pretty much the proximity effect just follows that average magnetization.
So what the point was trying to make earlier is that the that both the temperature and the seed hysteresis, as well as the coarser field, are all not really the same in the transmutated polymer and the GTM. So whatever its magnetic state is, it is different from, clearly it's one's a conductor and the other one's insulator, right? But it also shows kind of characteristics that are different from what I would expect.
So you really think that perhaps the magnetic state in the well is pretty detached? I mean, it's not like strongly exchanged coupled.
No, it's not detached. It's clearly proximity effect.
Sure, but you define two different coercivity fields.
But it looks like there are two different coercivity fields.
So that's enough. It's nothing like what we're familiar with.
Yeah.
If
we look at this magnet resistance at 20 Kelvin, there's nothing going on there. Like, there's nothing. You're just looking at that background NMR that is symmetric about zero. It's not until you get to the 5K area that you start to see anything. And then the rollover that you see at the lowest temperatures is much, much larger. Than
so our picture right fields. Now is we need the gadolinium type that it makes the Schwarzschild type into quantum magnetic. But on the other hand, everything about the Schwarzschild type, a lot of things about the Schwarzschild type magnetism are very different from, like, it's a conductor, it has a Curie temperature, it's different.
But this proximity to the magnetic state, I would imagine that it's strongly locked to the magnetic state of gadolinium.
But they're two different materials, right? So the induced magnetic state is a different magnetic state than
it's a different state, but it's strongly exchanged coupled.
It should be strongly exchanged coupled.
Right. It's very difficult to imagine any kind of sort of mutual coercivity in a sense, right? That's what you imply. It's not some kind of relative coercivity of one effective ferromagnet with respect to the other effective ferromagnet.
So you could test that if you could sort of make them parallel and anti-parallel.
Yeah, that's one thing we want to. We're thinking about sort of the structures that we can grow that'll give us that.
Is it possible that perhaps it's not just like a monodomain magnetic state, but rather some kind of other features, like a domain wall forming, something like that, and you're really looking at a domain wall dynamics of some sort?
It could be. I mean, it's really thin, right? So yeah. I think the larger coercive field might be, you know, just a trivial thing from the fact that the thing is really thin, right?
That's right. So it's easy to imagine that we have some kind of texture forming.
That you could see if you see whether this delta rho A really was this
Can I just try to understand these two figures? The magnetization, the TC is around 20 Kelvin, right? But the top figure, the magnetic resistance disappears around 5 Kelvin. So why does it disappear much earlier than?
That's the point. We were just trying to illustrate the differences here.
So top graph, that's a magnetic resistance. So this is reflecting the electrons in the quantum bar, whatever the properties are.
Right.
And the bottom graph is a grid measurement.
Oh, there's a total magnetization of all the devices.
Yeah, so that is not sensitive enough to pick up any of the magnetism in the quantum bar. That only picks up the magnetism in the GTA.
Okay, I get it.
But it's the same sample.
Yeah, so the interpretation is that the magnetization in the quantum well has a lower TC than the magnetization outside.
Yeah. Okay. So did you check the sort of classical theories of AMR?
Which are
SD scattering.
Yeah, so it fits beautifully. So if you go back.
That's the terminology, right? But then usually those theories give you a positive.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look for the literature,
there are a few negative ones.
There are a few negative ones, right? A few negative bulk ones, and there's also a particularly compressively strained, magnetically doped arsenides have a negative.
You know then from those theories what you have to do to get a negative one, what is the physics of the negative one.
But there are nice papers on it. Nice theory papers on it. So people have actually done also systematic experiments at a different strain for the negative stuff, the other ones, and then what they're looking at. And they've really seen experimentally that the sign changes as a function of strain. And these happen to be, so that's what's nice about STO, the electronic structure, is actually the conduction band looks very similar to the Lehmann's band of the arsenides. We have these typically generally conduction bands, similar to the heavy hole, light hole bands, etc. That's kind of the middle. So some of the properties are actually similar to hole
what do you think is kind of the biggest puzzle, the most urgent puzzle experimentally? Because there's a few things here, right? It wasn't clear to know.
So the whole goal of what we're doing is basically we are basically trying to induce new state, new controlled induce artificially designed states. The ferromagnetism was one. So then now this is Samarium tightening. We're looking at artificially induced ferromagnetism in two dimensions, which seems to possibly work pretty well. And so that's basically the whole goal of the project. So if we can controllably design ferromagnetism, any ferromagnetism in a two-dimensional system.
So I think also this community we're interested in, so there's no equilibrium effects, which you subject magnetic dynamics to microwaves, pumped currents, drive currents, induce magnetic dynamics. Is it something that you think is could be done in this type of systems? Then like pass very large currents through this 2D exercise that the magnetic state could, respond, or vice versa. Look at the microwave-induced, let's say, voltages, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it would definitely be interesting. I mean, we can't do such measurements.
Can you use FMR?
Principally, equipment is here. I don't know exactly how to do these experiments, so we didn't.
That will also be interesting whether you can see separate resonance, although it might be difficult.
Can you drive large currents?
Well, I was going to comment on that. There might be some just sort of experimental limitations on what the sample will take before it burns out, essentially.
How thin can you make stop and bottom paper?
I mean,
there's one limitation.
Oh, these are four top and bottom, the gallium titanate layers. And the strontium titanate layer for 3SRO is about 0.8, but I can make it 1SRO.
We still have the 2-deck there, what happens with the GTO, so this is a study we have done, this magnetism is strongly coupled with the optical tilts in the ferrocyte structure. What happens in these triple atoms that is to make it thin is that these tilts go away and actually the magnetism goes away. So that's the reason why the security temperature is only 20 Kelvin. That's already caused by the fact that it's only 100 Kelvin. So at some point we expect the whole effect to go away just because of GTO to make it thin.
So apart from FMR, another way to characterize the system is this technique developed in this community in the recent few years to drive, you don't even have to drive a large current, which you can drive small AC current through the 2-deck, and then it will wiggle the ferromagnet a little bit. And you measure the double frequency generation, let's say, in the transverse voltage. So that type of probe has become extremely useful for characterizing how magnetic state interacts with the currents in the 2-deck. And you don't have to drive the large current.
Okay.
In principle, if you drive large currents, you can switch and use very complicated dynamics. But that sort of double frequency generation, which is not linear effect, it's not really quadratic, it is the linear power of the microwave that you put in, but it may depend on sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that relies on this type of AMR anomalous Hall effect. But if you already have it built into your system, then I think it will be very useful if you just look at this double frequency generation.
Not double frequency generation, it's more.
Oh, amplification. What's that?
Yeah,
the amplification. Again, depending on your preferences, either amplification or double frequency generation. Same thing, essentially.
Thanks. There are a lot of processing limitations to this material.
No,
so.
But large current is another problem.
Well, large currents.
Yeah,
that's true. But like these measurements are all done sort of as grown with very simple four contacts.
Yeah, but maybe you can do just, can you do the same as on the AC? In principle, right? And then by AC, I don't mean any, you don't have like low resonant frequency, just, you know, people use like kilohertz, just, you know, you just need to modulate. And then it will be a little bit format, a little bit. Maybe it was exactly the same setup, you can just do it.
Okay, yeah.
It's just electrical measurement.
Yeah, let's try it, yeah.
Especially since these are pretty large with delta R.
Yeah, exactly. So that's.
Okay.
Thanks again.
No questions. Thank you very much again. So you are now relieved to go back to your work, but if you're interested in superfluid spin current, then you are very welcome to stay.
For giving me the opportunity to give a short pitch talk. This is a work that I've been doing with Yaroslav on superfluid spin transport and ferromagnetic insulators. Okay, so since it's a short talk, I'll delve right into the talk. Okay, so before I discuss spin superfluidity, I just want to say a few words about what conventional superfluidity is, and there's some useful analogy I can make that will be helpful in understanding it as well. So, we know that conventional superfluidity is described by a complex order parameter, psi.
Hey, you should widen yourself up.
No, I don't have a sound. Okay. Right. Thanks. Okay.
So, conventional superfluidity is described by a complex order parameter. It has two parts. So there's a constant magnitude part, which is determined by minimizing your free energy. And then you have the phase part, which describes the sort of degenerate manifold in which this complex order parameter lives. So if you want to pass, let's say, a superfluid mass current through a rod, for example, like this, you could think that there's a very useful mechanical analog of this. So think of this rod as being some sort of spongy rod. You know, so you've seen a swimming pool or something like that, you know, people swim on. Okay, so imagine that you start twisting it on one end, right? You start twisting the rod at one end. And the angle that you're twisting with is exactly analogous to this angle here. And you could see that because there's a certain stiffness to this rod, as you twist on one end, this twist is going to sort of travel down the wire, and then it's going to twist on the other side. So imagine now you twist this n times, 2 pi times n times, and then you stick the two ends together. Then you make a ring. And you know that this state is not going to be the ground state of the system, but it's going to be some metastable state. Because there's no way for you to untwist this 2 pi n rotations without crossing a large energy barrier. Okay. So macroscopic supercurrent or supercurrent will be that you have many multiple twists of 2 pi over the sample distance. And then that's sort of depicted here. And this sort of metastability is protected by topology. And basically, this topological charge is the number of twists you have in the system. And there's no way for you to continuously deform your 2 pi n state to a 2 pi n minus 1 state. Okay, so now let's link this sort of idea to magnetism. Okay. So the important point here is that the order parameter lives on this ring. And so in a magnetic system, there's a very nice way to sort of picture this if you have an easy plane anisotropy and you have, you're well below the Curie temperature. The magnitude is going to be constant, but then because of the easy plane anisotropy, the magnetism is allowed to live on this ring, and that's completely degenerate. But here, this angle phi is a real physical quantity. It's not this sort of U1 phase that you have for this order parameter, but it's really the physical angle that this magnetism makes with respect to the x-axis.
What does it mean? So
this is the.
This would be kind of derives magnetization as a complex variable real?
Yeah, so this is, I'm parameterizing the x and y components in terms of this complex quantity, which is sx plus i sy. So it's a parameterization. Right, so this is with an easy plane anisotropy, so an equilibrium.
Not a quantum mechanical phase or
anything. No, that's what I'm saying. This is really like a physical measurable quantity. Like for even for classical magnet, this would correspond to the actual angle of this moment in plane. Okay. But it's just a way of parameterizing in a complex space. Okay, so if you want to, so now if you make a system on this ring, and you could think of this being like the easy plane ferromagnet, and then you twist it n times. For you to get rid of one of the twists, you need to somehow be able to take the moment out of the easy plane. But that's of course costs a lot of energy because you have a strong anisotropy. So that's this is topologically protected. If you had an isotropic ferromagnet, you can always continuously deform a twisted state into a uniform state because you can just bring the moments towards the North Pole. And there's a continuous way to dissipate energy to do that. There's no energy barrier. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about is this analog of superfluidity, but in a ferromagnet with this easy plane anisotropy, so that we have exact analog of this sort of order parameter.
So in the
with
the ferromagnet, there's no superfluidity?
No. Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet, yes, but ferromagnet, no. Okay, so the notion of superfluidity that I'm going to talk about is actually not new. I mean, the people have thought about this before, and one paper is done by Alan MacDonald and his company. And I'm not going to go into details, but basically they show that if you have a metallic ferromagnetic system with some magnetic texture, and they looked at the evolution of the ground state as a function of this spin density wave order ordering wave vector, and they showed that you can have a metastable state in which this kind of spin texture exists, and this state will have a persistent spin current going passing through the system. Okay.
What he calls persistent spin current here, isn't that just exactly the same as what you have for RKKY interaction between two layers magnets?
Just exchange, whatever the orderly exchange is.
So it's exactly the same phenomenon.
It's just exchange.
Yeah.
No, it's nothing new Hamilton. It's just,
yeah.
For now, this is just like a semantic.
It just means if you have any stiffness, you'll get torque or current.
Right. Yeah. So spin current, which yeah.
We call a spin in the supercurrent
because it's a reactive response.
Right. Exactly. It's basically dependent on only the energy of the system.
Yeah.
But here, what they were looking at was sort of a static magnetic texture, and they didn't really look at sort of the precession of the system, of this texture, which will become important ingredient in this talk. Okay, so let me go into what we are interested in. So what we have in mind is a kind of a drag experiment. So we have a ferromagnet with easy plane anisotropy, and we want to be able to detect the consequence of the superfluid spin transfer and how that will be different from a system when the spin current is carried purely by magnons, some sort of thermally activated objects. So we want to look at how spin superfluidity is going to re-change it. So what we have here on the left side is a heavy metal, very strong spin orbit coupling, so we can use direct spin Hall effect to impinge spin current onto the interface. So we have sort of spin accumulation forming here. This is an insulator, so the charge degrees of freedom are gapped, but we have spin current that can pass through this material. And then on this side, we use inverse spin Hall effect to detect the charge current that's going to form in this direction. And what we're going to be interested in at the end is drag coefficient, okay, and see how that will change if we have superfluid transport. Okay, so to really get the essence of the superfluid part, I just want to talk about the system at zero temperature, in which case everything should be carried by the superfluid, and forget about sort of thermally activated magnons. Okay. And let's even consider the case when there's no damping in the system, just to get the essence of what the physics is. Okay, so in the long wavelength theory for the ferromagnet, you could write down Hamiltonian of this form here, where n is the unit vector pointing parallel to the spin, and a is the stiffness constant, and k is the anisotropy. So we have this out-of-plane, easy-plane anisotropy, which is parameterized by k. Now, if you put this into the Landau-Lipschitz equation and you calculate the dynamics, it's useful to parameterize it in terms of two quantities, phi and nz, where phi is the azimuthal angle and nz is the component of the spin sticking out of the plane. And this thing here has been written in the limit where you have strong anisotropy. So we've dropped small quantities, namely gradients and nz. Those are two sort of small quantities which we've written, and we've written that to a leading order in those small quantities. And this is nothing but a magneto analog of the Josephson relation for regular Bogoliubov superfluid state. And the supercurrent is defined by the gradient of the phase times a stiffness constant.
Okay, these relations are also
right? I'm sorry?
These relations are also.
I mean, this is just Landau-Lipschitz equation, rewritten in the limit where.
But also, yeah, I think that there have been some papers on magneto Josephson.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
To be honest, Garrett, if you can suggest what would be the original reference, good original reference, I would appreciate it, because somehow I don't even know what reference to put.
I only know that there was some guy in Berlin, I forgot the name.
No, but that's not, in the magnetic junction, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but that is not an original, again. I'm pretty sure this has been known before that.
Just correct
Landau-Lipschitz. Yeah, it's just Landau-Lipschitz, but written in the anisotropy limit.
Fancy language, right?
Okay. All right, so now what we want to understand is how this spin transport is going to occur at the interface so that this can be carried down the ferromagnet.
Sorry, sort of to interrupt, but maybe I should add here that we can just sort of put this into context, right? At this point, it's all very conventional stuff, right? But original question that we're asking, and we believe to the best of our knowledge, is original question, how this type of superfluid could be transported in the non-equilibrium setting, how that can really be transporting something, a constructed quantity from one reservoir to another in a non-equilibrium setting.
Right. I mean, that's eventually going to be the goal of this heterostructure, right? We're constructing this heterostructure to really transport some information in a non-equilibrium way. I mean, it's in that sense, it's kind of different from just, analyzing the internal energy, as Alan MacDonald, that kind of paper is sort of equilibrium physics. Here, we're really looking at, driving the system out of equilibrium and really transporting something from one side of the head structure to the other.
Not just one. It's an analogy to the other superconductor, you might say. Just if you look at the Bohr superconductor, superfluidic is nothing but the stiffness of the order parameter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you now connect the superconductor to just conventional normal metal contact, that superfluid aspect manifests in an infinite conductance of the circuit, and it can be utilized, for transmission lines and things like that. So
right. Yeah.
That's kind of analogous to that.
This is analogous to this, but you could do it at room temperature.
So
for example.
If you look in the bulk material, there's nothing special about the superfluid, but now you connect it to normal contact. Now you could actually use this aspect to essentially make a long range, or in some cases almost non-dissipative spin transfer between the normal contacts, between the regions which don't have any other stiffness.
Yeah.
So what you have at the interfaces is basically the analog to Andreas.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Are you sure?
Just to say,
yeah,
for
yeah.
me, not already
that
had some
kind of. Like, I mean, this, yeah. Right.
But just to. Exactly.
Well, I cited Sonim in the beginning.
People actually have speculated. Sonim has speculated, and also MacDonald, they have speculated about transport.
Yeah.
It was actually no theory for how that transport happens.
Really happens, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
For example, I mean, if McDonald's case, he only considers sort of static magnetic sector. I mean, in that case, it's not so clear how spin pumping is actually going to occur at this interface, so that actually spin is information is actually transported into the metal at which you can detect it. Right. So
there are certain ingredients that has not sort of, you know, things are not tied together in a convincing way. So this is what we're trying to do here. Okay, so at the interface, so this big arrow, of course, is kind of depicting the spin accumulation here. And if it's thermal equilibrium, all the spin moments are sort of in plane, right? And they're uniformly oriented in the ferromagnet. But when you turn on the spin accumulation here, that's going to cant by virtue of the exchange interaction at the interface. It's going to cant the moment out of the plane, and that's going to trigger precession of this moment across the ferromagnet. That's because you have this sort of conjugate relation between the SZ component and the phase of the moment. Okay, and stiffness will carry this information down the ferromagnet. Okay. So the boundary condition, so we can write down is this spin current here, net spin current that's passing through this interface, and the net spin current passing through this interface here, is given by, so at the left interface, it's given by two processes. So you have a spin accumulation, which gives spin transfer torque, and then you have precession. You also have this global precession, which is going to give you the damping, this spin pumping back into the metal. Okay. And no, I mean it's in the mixing conductance.
So your US is in Hertz?
Yeah, that's the H bar is one.
Okay, right. Okay, yeah. So there should be a there's H bar here. Yeah, there should be an H bar. Yeah. No, you're right.
H bar should be there.
There should be an H bar here.
That's a mistake.
There's an H bar should be there. Yeah. That's right. Okay. And the steady state solution one can write down for this bulk equation of motion is that you have a constant SD component, which basically gives a uniform canting of the moments out of the plane. And then you have this phase whose spatial dependence parameterizes the amplitude of the spin current. And then there's a uniform increase in the angle as a function of time, given by the global precession frequency, omega, which we assume to be uniform across the ferromagnet. But but you can also check this sort of doing numerics and really, you know, putting an accumulation there and seeing how it evolves. You can see that this is a well-defined steady state of the system, okay, long time. Okay, and omega here, which is the frequency, is related to the SZ component of the spin, which is by virtue of that relation there. Okay, so the boundary condition, so there's two parts. In the left side, you have the spin transfer torque contribution, and then you have the pumping contribution. On the right side, you just have the pumping contribution. And that's given here, and that has to equal the spin current, supercurrent inside the bulk, right at those two interfaces. Okay.
In the absence of Gilbert
damping. Yeah, this is all, it's all in the absence of Gilbert damping. I mean, assuming that the spin is completely conserved across the entire header structure. Then it's just a matter of solving a boundary value problem. And what you find is that that's the frequency at which this texture is precessing. And that's given by these the spin mixing conductance here. But what I want to focus on is this spin current that's passed through the system. Okay, it's just constant in this case because there's no damping. But this tells us that the spin current is actually just two conductances which are combined in series, which gives rise to, and this is all within linear response. Okay, the lowest order and the bias mu s, the spin current is given by series combination of the two conductances. Okay.
But I could add a comment to this. It's exactly like MSM, charge transfers from MSM junction, in which the impedance is given by the two Andreev conductances at the boundary. So that actually the mathematics here, if you can rewrite it in complete one-to-one correspondence with Andreev reflection. So the Andreev conductance is just mixing conductance.
Yeah.
And you have a zero impedance in the bulk. And here the bulk can be infinitely long and without damping there's zero impedance.
Sure.
In the bulk. And just impedance of the boundary.
Yeah.
But I think exactly the same for boundary conditions, there is a boundary contact resistances.
Oh, that's a huge difference, right? That the moment you introduce impurities, you're dead. Impurities. I mean, the Landau conductance, of course, it's a superconductor, it's a known purity.
Yeah, but here are here impurities.
Yeah, that's a condensate. That's a superfluid. So if you, it's going to be robust,
yeah,
against
yeah,
it's
going to be
impurity.
No, that's the point. It's as insensitive to impurities as a superconductor.
Yeah.
So you can add impurities. You know, the impurities are extremely strong. So
if you take into account the three-dimensionality of the whole
three-dimensional system. Yeah. If you put a huge notch somewhere on the side, this is just going to pin the condensate. So it will be the threshold for this physics. But beyond the threshold, the impurities have no effect. So it's
no effect. I think the damping is, of course, not.
Damping is going to be discussed next. As long as there's no damping, it's a superfluid.
Yeah, okay, but of course, you have no impurities.
Oh no, damping is not being included now.
Even magnetic impurities do not affect.
No, that's the point. As long as only damping, right? So don't any kind of elastic impurities, so the condensate is gonna average all of that. Unless it's some kind of microscopic notch or something.
Magnetic impurities affects it because that causes damping, so that
but whatever causes damping, that's gonna be lumped into the damping parameter. And even that is not gonna be very detrimental. So it's gonna be hurting you, but not as I guess we'll see.
I admit, we'll see one that probably hurts is one that breaks U1. So U1, it's going to be very fragile to U1 breaking. But that's another thing. That's probably the biggest source of it. Okay, so let's add damping, as there seems to be some demand in adding the damping. So I prepared a slide just now. So if I write down, so if I endow the Landau-Lipschitz equation with the Gilbert damping term and then do the same sort of approximation expanding to lowest order in the small quantities, you essentially arrive at this equation in the presence of alpha, the Gilbert damping. And steady state solution for the SZ component is still given by a uniform solution. But now the phase has a spatial variation, which is going to be different instead of a linear change, it's going to have some other function, namely parabolic. Okay, so in this case, from by this equation here, if you plug this sort of steady state solution into this bulk equation of motion, you see that the current dissipation is given by this quantity, which is proportional to alpha. So this is an inhomogeneous second order equation. You can solve it. The amount of spin current that's decaying inside the bulk over the sample length from 0 to L, it's just given by the integral of the second derivative of this phase, and that's just given by this quantity here. Okay, so that's the amount of spin current that's going to be lost through this Gilbert damping inside the bulk. So I have this sort of picture here where you inject spin current and it's just dissipating, and one side just it's going to be a little bit smaller. So if you go through the same song and dance and you calculate the frequency and the spin current on the right side, what you get is, okay, so without Gilbert damping, we get back, of course, the same result. But in the presence of Gilbert damping, you have an extra term in the denominator, which essentially gives an algebraic decay in the spin current that's being ejected on the right side as a function of the system size. Okay. But there is some critical length scale, well, crossover length scale, which is basically given by the ratio of the spin mixing conductance to the Gilbert damping parameter, which well, the units is not quite correct, but you just have to take the ratio of these two things. Below which, if the system size is smaller than this this crossover length, Gilbert damping is negligible. You get back this conserved transport regime. If you're in the other opposite regime, you definitely get the effects of damping, but that is only suppressed algebraically in system size. So in comparison to some diffusive transport, imagine that you have purely magnon-mediated transport of spin.
If I take two tunnel junctions in series and I put a metal in between, the resistivity, the conductance of this metal also scales linearly.
But if you have impurities, it has to depend. I mean, if the transport is diffusive, it has to depend on the impurities, right? I mean, of course, without impurities, you get ballistic transport, but no,
if you sandwich a superconductor between the two tunnel junctions, you're dead.
No, don't need a superconductor.
No, but that's the point. We have a superconductor. Of course, if you sandwich it by two tunnel junctions, that kills everything. Of course.
No, but magnetic insulator is kind of like a normal conductor where dual damping plays the role. So I'm curious.
That's what I mean. The distinction of course. So the distinction needs to be made here between the normal conductor in between and the, so if you now okay let's discuss the normal conductor case. So if the normal conductor would be just actually there's a paper by Shuf and Jan in which the space is a normal conductor. So in which the transport is by
anomalous. He's not talking about normal paper, he's talking about an analyte. You think of this as if this would be a normal metal, but where the magnetic impurities in the
You could say that there is an impedance. If you have a moment you turn on damping, there is an impedance that scales linearly with length.
That's all.
Sure. You can make all kind of analogs you want, but the point is here that it's okay. So the important distinction here is that now we're dealing with quasi-particles magnets or excitations that have finite length because of damping. The quantity we're transporting here is non-conserved, unlike charge. If you don't have the superfluid, if you're transporting the signal by ordinary magnets, that's the usual proposal. So there's a proposal earlier this year by Shuf and Jan and Sella. You namely just, just diffusive.
So then you get exponential decay.
Then you get exponential decay, and first of all, the signal is tiny, and you get exponential decay. So because of this finite lifetime, the ordinary diffusive transport does not actually transport signal pretty much in any significant way. The superfluidity, if there was no damping, then the superfluid would transport with zero impedance. Damping, that's kind of, that gives you dissipation, that makes it more like diffusive conductor of particles that have no, that have infinite lifetime. So you will say that this is analogous to diffusive transport of particles that do not decay, even though the magnets here do decay.
It would be the same if you take a ferromagnet.
In that case, you have two modes, though. Two sets of, in principle, you have two modes that can carry supercurrent.
Okay, so spin pumping does not give you additional damping because due to the supercurrent,
the momentum comes actually from the other metal side.
No, the spin pumping, that's a damping, that's under reflection on two sides.
On these two sides, locally there's sampling.
Mixing electrons on the left, mixing electrons on the right, that's your...
It does not increase your damping because the angular momentum is not coming out of the ferromagnet, but actually
from the other side. That's right, that's right. Right. So the current comes in, a little bit of it deposited in the bulk.
Right.
Right, and some of it comes out.
There is no angular momentum loss due to spin pumping because this angular momentum does not come from the ferromagnet itself, but from the other side, from the other quantum.
Okay, you could put it that way, yeah.
Okay, that's just for me to better understand.
It's been transported, right? So there's a backflow on the left, so that you could say it's a loss.
Right.
Okay. So we made some numerical estimates for how this effect will be observed, let's say, in an experiment, a realistic setup. So imagine you take a platinum, Higg platinum type heterostructure, and you have some thickness for the metal, which is given by D. So by spin Hall effect, direct spin Hall effect, the spin current that impinges this interface here is given by the charge current that's passed through the system times the spin Hall angle, and properly normalized. And then let's for now assume that there's no losses, no magnetic losses in the system, so alpha is zero, and we have symmetric interfaces on the two sides. Okay.
It's not that there are no losses. The thickness is less than that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean.
Which is 1 micron.
Yeah. I mean we're in the regime where transport is basically.
There's no.
Yeah, there's no decay.
In the limit regime of no decay.
Then the spin current that's passed into through this interface here will partition into two directions. Some of it will be passed back via spin pumping to this side, and some of it will transport to the right side. Okay, for symmetric system, you would expect that partition is 1/2, and so you have spin current that's coming in the right side is equal to the spin current that's going on the right side, or left side and right side, which is given by half of what was impinging initially. And spin pumping at the right interface is given by, using magnetic circuit theory, it's given by this quantity here. So you know what the global precession frequency should be. And then invoking Onsager reciprocity, one can find what the charge current is that's created by inverse spin Hall effect on the right side. Okay. So putting all this together, we get a drag coefficient, which is of order 0.1. So we've used platinum conductivity and spin Hall angle, spin mixing conductance, and the thickness for platinum, which is shown here. And we get a drag coefficient, which is of order 0.1. And this is orders of magnitude larger than what is predicted if the transport were carried purely by diffusive magnons.
So
this earlier PRL.
7 orders of magnitude larger than Kajwara experiment.
Yeah. I think it was like 10 to the minus 7 in their case, right? So it's like 6 orders magnitude larger.
Whatever they measure, which almost was the case. But the drag that if you get drag from the Kajwara experiment, it's 10 to minus 8 or something.
So this is I think really striking for me, right? Because we have really an orders of magnitude enhancement in spin transport somehow, you know, by introducing a easy plane ferromagnet, right? And this should be what one should be looking for. This sort of large enhancement in charge current that's created on the other side.
So basically this is the result you would also get if you would use a macro spin approximation, is that correct?
If you just had one spin here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you get, because you have the same physics here, basically, but with a big spin.
Oh, if you just, if you make this channel shorter, then it's a macro spin. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like spin convection is like this, and the macro spin is in plane. So that spin convection, that's processing that macro spin, and this then pumps spin out. And this result is even at zero temperature. You have this drag. So if you go to zero temperature, all the magnons freeze out and you have diffusive drag. If you go to high temperatures, magnons are there, but then they have exponential decay lengths. And if you put everything together, we get tiny drag.
Yeah.
But here, over like 1 micron thick insulating, you could get drag as large as, and if you play with some spin hole angle, maybe like a tangle or something like that, the principle could be 1. So that would be, I think, very, very strong.
Yeah, I think this is what is really the
macroscopically large insulator. So I was surprised on these numbers we put together, to be honest.
So how large would be the critical current to get this hill?
The critical current, this is really the main practical issue. Gilbert damping is a very minor issue here because it's low. The critical current is determined by anisotropies. So in this model, it's zero because it's perfect U1.
Yeah, but do you remember you had a pitch where you pointed out that the critical current for excitation go through the ionic ring?
Well, the critical current here is determined by anisotropy. So that's really, it's a kind of experimental.
Yeah, but you have a sort of back on the envelope.
Oh, no, here, that's zero, that's the point. In this idealized, setting, there's no critical current. It's very different from Kajwara. Then in the idealized setting, you already have a gigantic ripple current.
Yeah, but for practical cases, right?
Well, in Kajwara, there's intrinsic ripple current, even in the ideal case.
Yes, but what you have shown is that Karizana's critical current cannot be because they were much too low, right?
Yeah, but that's completely different geometry. Yeah, the critical current.
Oh, because it's...
There's no intrinsic critical current. The critical current here is just due to imperfections, like some kind of in-plane field component that breaks you in symmetry. If you have no imperfections, intrinsic critical current is zero. The point is that...
That would still be called spin accumulation magnetization normal.
The normal, right. So if you... the key assumption is that that in-plane magnetization has no anisotropy, in-plane anisotropy. In Kajiwaras, so basically you ask this question, if you do this type, now for this imperfect U1 setup, you apply this Kajiwara, you calculate critical current for the Kajiwara setup, in which you induce that instability, then critical current will be still 10 to 11, because you have to overcome that out-of-plane anisotropy. So you replace the frequencies out of band altogether. Yeah, there's no critical curve. Well, in the model, in practice, that's really the main issue. That any kind of small implant component of magnetic field will hurt.
Right. Yeah.
So that probably connects you to the Landau criterion here, right? So if you have too much texture or something, then.
Well, okay. There's that critical velocity, which is basically given by the square root of the stiffness times the anisotropy.
Is that
right?
Affected by impurities or so? I mean, that's somehow
Landau criterion is not affected by impurity, right? I mean, it's super fluid transport.
Yes, it's
something.
Strong, but out of time,
yeah.
That's something that actually McDonald did that back.
Yeah, that's what they look at in that case.
So by the time we worry about that critical current, you know, I'm on that cloud nine. Because by the time we have a strong super fluid.
Yeah, that's a large, really large. But there's also critical current associated with how large of a current you need to overcome, let's say, some sort of anisotropies in the plane, something that breaks you one symmetry. This critical current associated with that, which is probably going to be much larger than
that's,
this.
That's
yeah,
nice problem.
Yeah,
actually, my estimate is quite large, even for that estimate, not really getting rid of any straight field for a city.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Check on social
field. Okay, so.
Then again, but going back to Sony, right? You also looked at anisotropies in planes to see this kind of.
Yes, yeah. So there you get this fixing of the phase type phenomenon, right? But you just need the domain wall to be large enough so that you more or less have this washboard type spin transport. I mean, if the domain wall is very small, then you really have not much macroscopic transport, right? But that's just a crossover regime associated with that, right?
That's different.
I mean, from, yeah.
It's more like this is a spiral versus solitonic state. That's, again, that's all my, it's the
yeah.
issue. But
okay, so in, I hope, in the last 2 minutes or so, I just want to say, okay, so this is really the main essence of the, you know, this sort of prediction here, numerical prediction is the main essence, and we want to just say, okay, what does temperature do to this picture? Well, just want to say just a few words. So thermal corrections, right? So we could then, we developed a linear response theory to calculate what's the thermal contribution to the spin current through the system. So that's just some theory, just to show that I can do some. And then this is the Kubo formalism, and then you just have this usual linear response expression for the current. So in this case, the moments in the ferromagnet is basically in plane. So the spin current in the polarized in the z direction cannot be transported through the ferromagnet. So there is some healing length associated with the spin current that's injected converting into the condensate, okay. Which
thermal
is
thermal spin current.
Yeah, thermal spin current that's converted into the superfluid contribution. And then that length scale, the healing length scale, has to be compared with the ballistic decay length, which is basically given by Gilbert damping in our case here. And that is the rate at which that decay occurs is given here. So if we compare these two things, you find that as long as alpha is in a regime where it's much less than one, then this magnon to condensate conversion is efficient, in the sense that spin current by the thermal contribution to the spin current by the time it converts into the condensate, it has not appreciably decayed due to Gilbert damping. Okay, this is the regime that we're interested in, so that the decay within the bulk can be described using the usual condensate dynamics. So then what we're interested in is, okay, then this little contribution that comes in on the two sides, okay, coming in on this side and going out on the other side. And let's say we're well below Curie temperature, so T is much less than TC here. And we normalize the amount of thermal contribution to the spin the superfluid contribution with respect to this T over TC to the 3/2 and some spin magnitudes. And what we find is that there's a regime, crossover regime, set by anisotropy. The anisotropy sets a temperature scale below which the magnons are elliptical in nature. So you have a slightly different power law with which this thermal contribution decays. Decays as a function of temperature. And this decay goes like square root of T over TD in this normalized units. Now, if you go above the anisotropy scale, then the magnons don't feel the easy plane anisotropy, and the magnons go into a circular regime. And in that regime, basically get this sort of power law for the thermal contribution, which now plateaus at some constant, one can calculate explicitly within this linear response. Okay, so there's sort of two regimes in the thermal case. But of course, we are much below the Curie temperature. So these contributions are already pretty small, suppressed by this contribution here. So it's kind of, you know, for real, it's very hard to detect this correction probably.
It's absolutely fun to measure, but it's changing. It just gives a small thermal correction to this Andrea.
Yeah, so the Andrea, this sort of superfluid physics or the phenomenon is by far like the dominant contribution, which contributes to the transport. Okay, so that's all I really wanted to say with this talk. So thanks for your attention.
Additional questions?
And to what extent this analogy with superfluidity works? I mean, are there entropy waves, second sound?
Yeah, that's something that we're really interested in, like second sound, for example. Right? I mean. Mm-hmm. In principle, okay, so in this calculation, we haven't really looked at the physics of the bulk. But if we really look at the physics of the bulk, we should be able to build some sort of two-fluid model where you have a condensate interacting with a thermal cloud and be able to write some sort of coupled, you know, hydrodynamics, let's say, for the bulk.
Are there some effects like this thermomechanic effect which exists in superfluid when we call this fountain or whatever, you know?
Fountain effect.
Oh, yeah.
The fountain effect. Yeah.
There's a fountain effect as well.
Yeah, we have a fountain effect too. Yeah, we're looking into that actually now. We're exactly right now. Yeah. So that's something that
definitely exists in
this language too.
Silas? So what's the crossover length that you were kind of talking about earlier that's set by the mixing inductance and the alpha? Sam is in your paper. So the ratio of mixing conductance to the same, so it's like a micron scale, yeah, yeah, yeah. Same as the same length scale, and then
is there any analog to the vector potential you could introduce in charged superfluid?
The vector potential, you
charge could do that.
No, it's a minimum.
The analogy of, you mean like it is.
You have a phase of the condensate wave function.
Yeah.
And to the gauge invariance, it couples to the electromagnetic potential in a certain.
Right, right, yeah. But that's.
That generates your. All the non-trivial properties of a superconductor.
Maybe strength.
Yeah.
Basically, we don't have anything. We don't have anything like this gauge structure, dynamical gauge structure. Maybe if you couple it to some other degrees of freedom, like magnetoelastic or something like that. Even like going to, like if you like also rotate it, like in a full superfluid, I don't think that will also be anything interesting. Rotation will just give you some xenon field, it's not going to be interesting. So we don't have an analogy of dynamical gauge structure.
More questions? Then maybe SO has an announcement.
Oh, right. So besides doing this, I'm getting married by tomorrow. Besides my responsibilities as a physicist, I also am a social outings coordinator. So tomorrow we have a hiking event up one of the front country trails in front country Santa Barbara. We have a hiking event tomorrow. So we're planning to meet here at 10 a.m. at KITP. And then people who will be kind enough to drive will drive us to the trailhead. So it's probably an all-day event. And at the end, there will be we usually go to the Japanese restaurant to have some nice sea urchin.
We also go to a Japanese hot spring, right? Oh, really?
So apparently this trail also has a hot spring.
There's a natural hot spring in the state park, so there is. So that means who wants to go hiking afterwards, we can have a relaxing spot.
So we
are here in the U.S., so you have to bring your swimming trunks because there might be other people as well.
So how difficult is the hike this time?
It's 11 miles. That's the longer version. There's also shorter version, but we can decide. That's a good question. I think it was 2,000 feet or something. Yeah. View is really supposed to be nice at the top.
It would be nice if that's only the extreme athletes have signed in, so I'm the weakest link at the moment, so maybe someone
Okay, so thanks. All right, that's it.